members are out with students, so they are going to step in a minute, and we will call quorum when they come in. But I think we can begin to have the conversation with Senator Eaton. Thank you so much, and welcome to our committee. We're excited to hear your ideas. We seldom have a conversation about chemical dependency in education, and I think it's very important that we talk about it. So I really welcome your bill and the ideas that you're proposing. So please go ahead and introduce yourself and start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chris Eaton, I'm proposing Senate File 366, the recovery schools in Minnesota. You want to move it? I'm waiting for a member to move.
I move.
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm just trying to organize my papers here. So, Senator Franzen moves Senate File 366. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would is an act relating to education finance, creating additional funding sources for students in approved recovery programs, appropriating money and amending Minnesota Statutes 2012 Sections 126C.01 by adding Subdivision 126C.05, Subdivision 8, 126C.10, Subdivision 1, and by adding a subdivision proposing coding for a new law in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 124D.
Yes, the testifiers, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name and the agency or organization you represent for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senate Education Policy Committee. Thank you for allowing me the honor of testifying before you today. My name is Paul McGlynn. I am the Executive Director of Sobriety High Charter School, which is one of several recovery schools in Minnesota. Want me to go on with my testimony at this point?
Please.
Okay. I'm testifying today on behalf of all Minnesota recovery schools that serve students struggling with addiction issues. Recovery schools offer students grades 9 through 12 a safe, sober place to recover from drug and alcohol addiction and at the same time receive an accredited high school education. Young people who have found successful sobriety in addiction treatment centers must eventually return into their normal lives. In this return, they are faced with the very daunting situation of re-enrolling in the regular high schools, where they will be exposed to the same environment and people who they used drugs with before their treatment. The temptation to fall back into their drug use is often too overwhelming to resist. Recovery schools offer a deeply supportive alternative high school setting for these young, courageous students who have committed themselves to sobriety. These schools work true miracles in the lives of young people and their families. The most significant miracle being that these young people actually have a school that is a safe, sober, and recovery-driven community where they can go every day and earn a high school diploma. For 8 years, I have seen the wonderful hope and healing that these schools bring to young people and their families. I am grateful to be part of such a mission. However, the mission of recovery schools is one that needs many resources, such as recovery counselors, social workers, psychologists, and other health services. In order to genuinely serve all the needs of their students, they must offer many services that are beyond the scope of educational state aid to a public school. Thus, recovery schools often suffer from financial struggles. Some of the significant and tragic consequences of this financial strain on recovery schools are the incredible loss of recovery schools over the last 4 years. In 2008-2009, there were 13 recovery schools in Minnesota, with 490 seats available to students. Now, in 2012-2013, there are only 7 schools left with only 278 seats available. This is a loss of 43% of available seats for students in recovery in only 4 years. In 2011, approximately 5,500 young people between 12 and 18 years of age were admitted to substance abuse dependency treatment in Minnesota. That means that in 2012, less than 5% of these young people will have access to a recovery school due to the precipitous loss of seats available. Clearly, recovery schools face a tentative future. The Minnesota Recovery School Task Force is working to ensure that recovery schools are a viable educational option for students in chemical dependency recovery. Recovery schools are mentioned as a promising practice in both the state and federal drug control policies. If we truly want to improve outcomes for our young people who have made the brave choice to embrace recovery, it is extremely important to keep recovery schools open and viable. Today, I am here to implore your Education Policy Committee and the Senate to pass the bill, HF 165, which would allow Minnesota recovery schools the financial support they need to serve young people who are choosing a sober, healthy life. Thank you for your time and consideration in this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dear Madam Chair and the Senate Education Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Tracy Bauermaster. I am the lead teacher and special education teacher at the Insight Program, which is a recovery school within the White Bear Lake Area Learning Center. I am also past chair of the Association of Recovery Schools, which represents secondary and collegiate recovery school programs at the national level. Mr. McGlynn and I are representing the Minnesota Recovery Schools Task Force in supporting the continued livelihood and growth of recovery schools in our state. As Mr. McGlynn mentioned, recovery schools provide a valuable service for young people that are considered by both the state and national drug control policies to be a promising practice and a vital part of the chemical health continuum of care. Investing in the recovery of young people with chemical health issues while they are still in high school saves considerable money in the long run, as it ensures that more students who have gone through treatment will continue to maintain sobriety as they complete their high school and emerge into a successful adulthood. These students, however, have multiple complex needs that require services beyond what a general high school provides. Let me draw a picture of how my program operates and the students who are served. Insight is housed within two classrooms of the White Bear Lake ALC, which serves as a group room home base for the student and Insight office. The Insight students start off each day with a group session, which is run by a licensed alcohol and drug counselor and myself, where we discuss relapse, prevention strategies, coping skills, and other topics designed to support their recovery. The students then move as a cohort from class to class within the ALC. No other ALC students are allowed in the Insight classes, and interaction between the groups of students are discouraged so the Insight students can focus on creating a new identity as a recovering young person. Insight has been in operation for 12 years. Almost 300 students have participated in the program since it began. Our capacity is 15 students, but currently we have 17 enrolled, two who are accessing PSEO at Century College and at McNally Smith. We serve students across the East Metro. Our students come from Cottage Grove, East Bethel, Woodbury, Chisago, Montemedi, Oakdale, Stillwater, St. Paul, and White Bear Lake. Of the 17 enrolled, 7 have IEPs. And 100% of them have mental health diagnoses such as depression, anxiety, attachment disorder, PTSD, ADHD, social anxiety, borderline personality disorder, and so on. Our chemical health counselor is employed half-time and shares her services with the ALC, as do our very part-time social worker and school psychologist. We have one guidance counselor that serves the entire school, so 200 students with one guidance counselor and the heavy-duty needs, mental health needs of our students. This current model is not sustainable under existing financial structure, and as all of the staff duties that we have, all of the staff duties are shared with the regular ALC and also other schools in our district. So it's often, even though we have the structures we have in place, we struggle to meet the high needs of our students under the current structure. But right now with this bill, we have the opportunity to change the trajectory of our young people who have encountered drug and alcohol issues from a future of homelessness, hospital, treatments, or prison, to the future that we see over and over again of students completing their high school education, going on to successful college careers and work careers, and turning into very productive members of society. We see it over and over. This bill will help bring the services needed to this population to increase the number of recovery schools in Minnesota and to strengthen those in existence. Thank you so much for your time today. I plead that you support Senate file number 366 and help us make our mission come to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me just do this before we continue, and let's put on record that we have a quorum now. Yes, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doeslin, and I represent the intermediate school districts. And while Ms. Bauermaster and Mr. McGlynn talked about the need, I'm just going to provide a little bit of information about the details for you. I represent the intermediate school districts. There's three of them in the metropolitan area. They provide, individual school districts are members of intermediates, and intermediates provide unique services or high-cost services to member districts, primarily in the areas of special education and career and tech, but they also do a lot of work in area learning centers. Now, we are talking about recovery schools. I just want to make sure you understand that recovery schools are, there's seven of them in the state. They are either a charter school, or they run through a school district, individual school district area learning center, or they may be run through an intermediate school district area learning center program. The areas that have recovery schools in Minnesota are Mankato, Fergus Falls, Eden Prairie, White Bear Lake, Burnsville, Minneapolis, and Coon Rapids, and I think that's seven of them. So just the details of the bill. So Senate File 366 would provide support for Minnesota recovery schools by providing two funding sources. The first is it creates a state aid reimbursement for 20% of the salaries of support staff, which are listed in the legislation. Again, this will help sober schools address the concern that recovery programs are hard to keep in operation because the unique staff that they need to provide the chemical and alcohol addiction treatment portion of the program. And then secondly, it increases the pupil weighting from 1.2 to 1.7 to allow students that are in a recovery school program to have additional time for things such as credit recovery. For instance, a student who's gone through drug and alcohol treatment has missed school for maybe a month or 2 months or maybe 3 months, and they need some additional time to make up the credits that may have been missed while they were going through the treatment program. I'm available for any questions, and again, we certainly would just appreciate your support for this legislation.
Thank you to all of you. I am wondering if we have any statistics. I have heard anecdotally that we have a higher number of kids that are dealing with chemical dependency today, and that more and more we are dealing with suspensions that are related to chemical dependency, addiction to medications, and et cetera, that schools are struggling with. Could you provide some overview of what schools are having to deal with today in terms of, you know, the difference in terms of access how do you see the problem today versus, you know, 10 years ago?
I do not have any hard data regarding that, but I will give you anecdotal as well. Over the 8 years I've worked with the schools, I've spoken with parents, school officials, and students. Probably the most honest overview of the high schools are from the students. The students are the ones who plead with their parents, "I cannot go back to that high school. You can get any drug you want in that high school any day." And they will tell us that pretty regularly. It is all available. It is all there. And so from those stories we know and those narratives, we know that there's a lot of access to drugs there and there's a lot of pressure. Obviously, the types of drugs have varied too and widened. There's, of course, the mainstays are marijuana and alcohol, but you will find meth. You will find a lot of prescription. Abuse of prescription drugs is now happening. There is heroin use is back up. We know that from looking at statistics and the rise of heroin use. I guess the most important information for you to hear is this. Our students tell us basically that had they returned to their schools, they would have lost their sobriety and probably lost their education, at least, if not worse. And the parents who have students stay with us longer than 3 months and up to several years are extremely grateful. I just had a parent at our board meeting last night say to us, without this school, we would have lost our child. And he was a heroin addict, and now he's been with us for 2 years and has been sober for those 2 years. And that student swears that were it not for this school, he feels he would have lost his life. He bases that on the fact that two of his friends who are also using heroin, one of which went through treatment and one did not, have both lost their lives over this period of time. So it is a very serious issue in our state, probably nationwide. And to give you the seriousness, and I'll close with this, probably on a weekly basis, I have calls from other states that don't have sober schools, and they hear about sobriety high, and they want it so desperately. They'll come, we've had them come from Arkansas, New York, Mississippi, New Mexico, and they come to us and they visit with us and they look through our schools and they say, how can we create this in our state? We need this. And we help them as best we can. But what they run into is a lot of funding and legislative issues around starting schools like this. What I commend Minnesota is it's probably one of the states with the most prolific recovery schools. And we're doing a lot of work, and we'd like to continue doing that work. So, again, I don't have the hard data. I could probably get that for you if you needed it. So.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful so we can sure. put in context the need for supporting our kids with this kind of support. Yes.
Madam Chair, Valerie Dozlin again from the Intermediate School Districts. Real quickly, I believe I'm certainly not the expert on the Minnesota Student Survey that is the Department of Education administers, but I believe there are a number of different questions that ask about access to drug and alcohol, and I will certainly work with my folks to try to get you the data that you request, and I'll look into the student survey as well for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dozlin. I think that would be very helpful because I think that that survey, I remember, you know, the first two that were put in place, and it really was astounding, the amount of information that we were able to collect from students. So I think it's important that we educate each other about what's happening in the schools. Senator Eaton, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I just wanted to reiterate that many of these students have co-occurring disorders. They're, like was explained, anxiety and depression and things like that. And they're able to get treated for both their chemical dependency and their mental health issues in these schools. And because of their chemical dependency, they get in trouble with the law also, so they'll often have juvenile justice issues that the school helps them work through. I think that supporting these schools saves us a lot of pain for the parents and the people involved, the children, and also saves the community a lot of money.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the author of the testifier, Senator Chamberlain?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I missed the first part, constituent outside. How were they? Maybe you mentioned this already. How was this supported previously? How did they get funded previously? And how much would this cost with additional dollars? I think the dollar.
Ms. Bauermaster.
Thank you.
Tracy Bauermaster, lead teacher for the Insight Program in White Bear Lake. And they are through a variety of ways. Each school district or school program worked, and I'm sure Mr. McGlynn here will talk about his school too in a moment, but I can speak about White Bear Lake anyway, and that we exist as part of the ALC, under the ALC financial budget. And the additional funding we have to scrape for through grants, through county funds if we can get them, to pay for our chemical health counselor, to pay for any extra activities that we do beyond what the Area Learning Center would do. And my salary, for instance, I'm half-time through the district as a general ed teacher, and I'm half-time special ed for the entire building. And so that allows my half-time through general ed is to pay for running the general running of the Insight program. And so it's through And I believe this is the case with all of the ALCs. There isn't any, or with all of the recovery schools in Minnesota, there hasn't until now been a set financial model that all of the schools follow, or a set stream that all of the schools draw from financially.
Paul McGlynn, Executive Director of Sobriety High Charter School. I can tell you that Sobriety High Charter School has never, even in its inception as a charter, ever been financially viable from educational money, from the money that the state gives per student. They've always relied on private donations. In fact, Sobriety High had a foundation that exclusively raised money for its schools, and it raised at least a third of its revenue. The reason we needed that is because we had social workers, LADC, and other health official, mental health people on our staff that educational money simply did not pick up. So never have we been viable without private donations. This is why we seek to increase the funding per student so that we can start to get more self-reliant. Because as you well know, as of 2008, I don't know if you know, but a lot of the private donations started to dry up very quickly in that recession. We certainly saw that happen, and our foundation had to close due to that. Since then, we've had to make many decreases in our staffing and in our salaries. Most of our teachers are not full-time anymore. They work at 0.50, 0.75. But to give you some idea of their dedication, I don't know one of them that doesn't work an 8 to 10-hour day, even at that. Basically, in answer, we've never been able to be financially viable off the educational money, and we've always had to supplement with at least a third in donations.
Just Madam Chair, follow-up, Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. So to clarify, do you receive basic formula money?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. So what you're asking for here is some additional that would be for recovery onto that formula. And what do you expect the cost to be then? Do we know yet? Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain, we have a lot of that data, but that'll be taken up in the fiscal committee. This is a policy that we're discussing here today in the education committee.
Thank you, Senator Eaton, for clarifying that. I want to make sure,
Chair,
Senator.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
I thank you. There's a number, right, Senator Eaton? I mean, I simply ask, we should have some idea, and to simply say, well, we'll take that up in finance. Okay, I accept that. That'll be debated there. I'm not debating the numbers. I'm just asking, do you have an idea what this costs? So, Madam Chair, I would appreciate an answer to that. I don't think that's out of line.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain, Senator Eaton, let's make sure, you know, we have the bills that we have before us, some of them have just a little bit of policy, significant implication for finance. Briefly, if you could answer the question about the finance, that would be certainly appreciated because the members could have, kind of put context. Most of the members do serve in the finance division so that they will hear this again. But clearly, that's a long discussion. We're here to really review the language that is before you, the concept that is presented to you. And, briefly, if you could respond, if you don't have the information, that's okay, too, because we don't expect you to have that information with you today. We didn't ask for it. And these will be referred to the finance. But if you have that information, we would very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason that I hesitate is that we do have a fiscal note, but we don't agree with it, and we're having it redone. Okay. But I can give you the information, or she can give you the information that we have.
We don't need that fiscal note today, but I think Senator Chamberlain has a good point. You know, if you have a kind of a global perspective of the cost, I think it's good for the members to be informed about it. So if you have it, just let us know. If not, just make sure that this information is clearly provided in the finance. Senator Nelson and then Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. regarding, first I'd like to note or maybe you already visited about this. I'm sorry I got in late due to some other meetings. I'm wondering about your graduation rate and some of the results. Have you already discussed that with the committee? Oh, could you tell us about some of the results then from the recovery high schools in Minnesota?
Thank you.
Again, I don't want to give you exact data. I do actually have that exact data back at the school. I didn't bring that today. But I'll tell you that what happens is if we can keep a student for about 3 months, there's a transient nature to the students we serve because they are going on a journey to recover from addiction. We will lose many, a high percentage in those first couple months. They'll relapse or they'll go back to use. That's a fact. But the ones that we do keep, 3 months or longer, the graduation rate of those kids is like 85 to 90% if we can keep them that long. It's very high. But we have to have that buy-in initially in the recovery, in that journey, in the stopping the use of drugs and alcohol. Once we have that buy-in from the student and the family, we're very successful.
Thank you, Mr. McLean. And it would be very good to have that information.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm also wondering, two additional questions. I'll put them together. One is a short answer, one's a little bit longer. The short question is, I'd like to know how many recovery high schools we have in Minnesota. And then if they're meeting the need, in other words, are there enough of them? And then regarding funding, which is not the purview of this committee, but I would, Ms. Dalsland and I believe, worked on the third-party payer, or maybe that was someone else. But last year we passed third-party payer, which was allowing or making sure that our schools are able to bill for those services that are not educational, but they're provided in the school system. And I'm just curious if that might be helpful with our recovery high schools in that might you be able to access some of the payments from whether it be Medicaid or insurance companies for particular services that are being provided in the recovery high schools?
Thank you. I think that the first part of your question, Senator Nelson, was presented here about the number of schools. You can briefly repeat that.
Seven are currently in open.
Thank you.
But at one time, there had been as many as 17 in Minnesota, and four or five years ago, we had 13. So there's been a decline in the number, and it's because of financial reasons and other reasons that have caused the schools to close.
And it will be good for us to keep in mind the question that Senator Nelson is asking for the third-party payer, because I think that will be good for the finance. Just briefly, if you will have to answer this again in finance, so just briefly if you could state that so that members know. Go ahead.
Very good question, Senator Nelson. Again, Valerie Dozlin from the Intermediate School Districts. And the question about the health insurance or the third-party billing was the exact same question I asked when they brought this bill to me. My understanding is that health insurance doesn't often cover drug and alcohol dependency counseling for people that get it covered. They're fortunate, but my understanding in conversations with them is it's not often covered.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mr. McGill.
It's an excellent question, Senator, and something I've explored since I've been the director. My understanding is that as a public school, I am a public school as its own district. We're District 4109. In order to access those type of monies, we would have to be a care and treatment program. We are not. We are a public school that offers a safe, sober environment. And with that, we get public school aid, the normal allowance per student. But not beyond that. There are some special ed monies that come to us, and about a third of our students are special ed. I access as much of those as I can, but it simply doesn't cover the cost of the LADC, social workers, and other health professionals that I must employ to have a viable recovery program. Another thing that we haven't brought up here is there's a transient nature. I did say to that, to give you some idea, there's a lot of front-loaded costs to running these schools. We help parents. They come to us, they call us, they email us, and they say, please help us. Our kid's getting out of treatment or our kid's run away. We need help. So we have to front load a lot of mental health services and social work services to get those kids through our door to help them get sober. And, again, because of the transient nature of the world of addiction, we lose some of those kids. To give you an idea, we're at a 60 ADM currently at our between our two sites. And we put through 126 kids this year. So you get some idea of how expensive it is to get each of those kids through the door. Each kid is set many, many hours of work through counseling, interviews, intake, getting them through our tie system, getting their credits in, and credits are from all over usually because, they've had a rough go of it and they've been through many schools. So we won't try and get them all organized, set up, and ready to go, and we lose them. That's a lot of money, and it's hard to cut our staff down to fit a 60 ADM and still give all those services to students. And so it becomes a vicious circle. If you can't offer the services and you can't hold, you know, create that safety net, they fall through. And you keep losing the money, you keep cutting back the staff, and you can't get the services. So what we need is a sustainable amount of money that's coming on a regular basis, rather than looking to donations that can come and go, you know. And we haven't been able to sustain our safety net for students without the regular money. So that's basically my
answer. Thank you, Mr. McLean. Senator Thompson.
I'll pass, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say thank you very much for being here today, and I appreciate the work you've done as a former high school principal. I'm familiar with your program, and I appreciate your work. As I read your proposal, there's really two funding streams here. One is the 20% the state would pay for the special services, and then also in addition to the basic formula. Because that 20% is pretty fluent from year to year, I'd suggest that perhaps you look at adding on to the basic formula so you have more of a hard set dollar amount, contractual agreements with these individuals, people leaving positions. Yeah. I just see kind of a problem in coming up with a dollar figure, and every year it changes. And
thank you, Senator Klassen. We will look at that for the Finance Committee.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you. Any other questions, members?
Madam Chair, and I just also want to salute the testifiers for their efforts trying to save kids. We've had testimony about the thousands of Minnesota students that don't make it to graduation. They're a part of the team that is doing whatever they can to help put these kids' lives back together. Kids whose lives are totally at risk, looking for direction. It's a lot of effort for those that they're able to save. That's great. My heart goes out for those that aren't saved, but whatever we can do, we need to do it. The cost by not is much more expensive later.
Thank you, Senator. Well said. No other questions? So Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 366 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Members, next in our agenda, we have a presentation that I hope is, it has been for me just to review it before today, very helpful. So lots of things that I am learning and kind of reviewing again, although some of them just happened during the last 2 years, they are quite complicated. So I'm happy that we have a chance to review it. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Something I wanted to raise in the last meeting, you'd indicated that, you know, you felt we should have amendments put in 24 hours ahead, and we could debate the merits of that. We certainly never demanded that in the majority 2 years ago. I'm not sure that's the best thing for the discussion, be that as it may. I'd point out that the first we heard of this bill that was just heard was yesterday at 12:18 p.m., 23 hours and 48 minutes before the hearing was to start. And, of course, the rules, which we don't adhere to strictly, we understand there are exceptions and things move fast, especially at the end of the session, require 3 days or recommend 3 days. And then we get here, and there's a fiscal note, but the author doesn't like it, so we don't get the fiscal note. And I would argue that that's more than just procedure, because you really can't look at policy in a vacuum without considering the cost of a bill. In other words, there are all kinds of good policies that I could probably stand behind if it weren't for the cost. So what it appears to be is, literally, if we were to abide by your rules, no amendments today. And then secondly, we don't get what I consider to be all the very relevant information in order to determine how we should vote on these bills. And I guess I would just say I hope that's not the practice. I hope that doesn't continue, because I don't think that serves the public well, and it certainly doesn't serve people well who would like to make changes to a bill, or you know, it doesn't look good, I guess is what I'd say.
Thank you, and the point is very well taken, Senator Thompson. I want to make absolutely sure that the members and the public know what happened today was kind of an exceptional thing. We had some members who were kind of ready to present, but they have to be in another committee, and we were asked to, really support that and help the members do what they have to do in other committees. So this is not going to happen. Brad is working very diligently to learn kind of the pace of the Senate and the House. They do have a little bit of a different process, and he's trying very hard to, you know, keep us on task and keep our agenda clear. So I'm hoping that, you know, as of next week, we will have a better sense. We and again, members, I have asked all of you. Some of you have introduced a bill, but you have not made a request for a hearing. So we were very confused about do you actually want a hearing on that bill or not? So we had to call you one by one, and Brad has been trying to organize that. So it's more our apology, and we're going to try to do our very best to accommodate you so that you can have your testifiers here and you can have information ahead of time. I hope that we can adhere to the rule of 24 hours. Obviously, I do not expect in situations like this that we will enforce that, because it will be so unfair that I ask that you have your amendments, you know, submitted 24 hours in advance. But we're doing our best to accommodate members that have to go to other committees and testify because of deadlines. So
thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the response.
We have Mr. Naumann here. Okay. Mr. Naumann, we're going to start with you. We don't let you go of education, don't we? For a while. We're going to count on your expertise and your knowledge to help us really guide this conversation. So I appreciate that you brought this information to me, because I understand that there was some kind of misunderstanding on how this information was presented earlier. So Mr. Naumann felt that it was very important that we understand what is in policy right now in terms of integration revenue, and how we need to have that in context in order to move forward with recommendations if we bring that before the committee. Senator, Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair, members, it's a pleasure. Eric Naumann on the staff of Senate Counsel and Research. Wanted to take a couple of moments, and I've handed out the language that I'm going to speak to begin and maybe put a little context around the Integration Revenue Program. I know that you're going to begin having some conversations here and wrestling with those issues, but there are some, and I also understand that this is not the Fiscal Committee, but it is the first occasion where we have begun talking about the Integration Revenue Program this session, and so I thought it might be useful to come back. It's good to be back. And speak a little bit about the language that was passed in 2001 and how that relates to some of the fiscal implications that this committee and the Finance Division will have to wrestle with. So first, a little bit of history. Back in 2011, the legislature and the governor negotiated a compromise, and that language sits in front of you. The compromise was to repeal the Integration Revenue Program effective fiscal year 14. So after fiscal 13, the revenue was technically repealed. The repealer is on the back page of the document that I gave you. It's paragraph D, 124D86. So after fiscal 13, technically the statutory program is gone. But the compromise included establishing a task force, and the language in paragraphs A, B, and C speak to the contents of what that task force was supposed to do, essentially come forth with a recommendation, report that recommendation to the legislature for consideration. The compromise also, however, and this is what I'd like to spend most of my few moments here speaking to, established a base for fiscal year 14 and 15. So there was no allocation formula, but dollars were set aside. They had been forecasted for 14 and 15. In the November forecast, you'll see the dollars there for the Integration Revenue Program. And then in paragraph F, we also, the compromise also set forth levy authority for 1 year into the next biennium, and that would be fiscal 14. It says taxes payable in 13, but that's actually fiscal 14. So what that means is, looking into the budget that you're setting, we have aid dollars that are set aside for this purpose. Doesn't mean the legislature has to spend them on this, but it just means that their dollars have been allocated for that for this program for consideration for both 14 and 15. The levy authority exists for fiscal year 14, but not in 15. Now, the peculiarities continue. It would be nice if it stopped there. But because we repealed, we as the legislature and state government, repealed the overall program, but then set aside dollars in the language that you have here, under the budget accounting rules that we operate under, this is considered a grant. It doesn't have any authority to actually be distributed in the formulaic way that we did under the old statutory program. And whenever you establish a grant, the budget rules call for carrying those dollars forward into the subsequent biennium. So that means that the aid carries forward into 16 and 17 at about the $68 million level. And this is because we haven't spoken any further on the point since 2011. If, however, the legislature does nothing this year, all of that aid goes away. Now, I know the governor has a recommendation, and I'm sure this committee and the division will speak to it, but I at least wanted to contextualize the choices and where the statutes lie at this point. Aid for 14 and 15, projections for 16 and 17, all of which evaporate if nothing, you know, those dollars that have been set aside will evaporate under if the legislature does nothing, and levy authority for fiscal year 14. Madam Chair, that's a mouthful. I will pause there and see if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'll scurry away.
Mr. Nauman, this was incredibly helpful. I was very glad that we were able to have this information before us, because members, you know, I think that it was Senator Thompson that said, you know, it's important to have the context of, you know, do we have money, do we not, these concepts are good or bad, can we afford to pay for them, do we want to find the money? So I think that having this information is helpful. Do you have any questions, members, for Mr. Nauman? Mr. Nauman, I'm sure we will have more questions later on, but I think this was very helpful, so I really appreciate that you
certainly
were able
Madam Chair.
To come.
This is a little bit of an unusual circumstance where a program is repealed and then we establish dollars going forth into the future for the legislature to wrestle with, so it's something worth being aware of.
Madam Chair?
Absolutely. Yes,
can
Senator.
Can I ask one question?
Senator Wicklund.
So the dollar amounts that are listed here, how do those relate to dollar amounts that may have been proposed, like in the governor's budget? Are those the same?
Madam Chair and Senator Wicklund, the flippant answer is they don't. The governor has come forth with a completely separate program. I believe it's about $315 multiplied times the pupil units, and I think there's some weighting factors in there. I have to confess, having since walked away from K-12, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about the formula. But the formula does include in fiscal year 14 an aid component and a levy component. So there is a linkage to what's built into the language that's in front of you. But the governor has a new program recommended for you all to wrestle with. And, of course, it's your discretion to do something completely different if that's your pleasure.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Nauman. And Senator, we have the bill that we received from the governor's office. We went over that in the finance. So it's $73 million additional for 14 and 65-something for 15. So that's additional. That's precisely where we're having this conversation here, members, because we want to kind of bring this together. We want to make sure that we put in context what we want to do in policy with this. Technically, this is the beginning of the conversation here. We have these changes that were made in policy that are before you that Mr. Nauman is talking about now. We have the recommendation that the governor presented to us. And then we also have bills. I have introduced a bill. The House has introduced a bill. So we're beginning that conversation to see how all of you could engage in the process of defining what do we do, since we technically have money I think safely is safe to say to 2016, correct?
Madam Chair, I don't want to overemphasize that point. Yes, dollars have been set aside for integration and earmarked in the language in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you could roughly think of it as dollars for this program. I do want to be clear that there are dollars that are in the education finance jurisdiction, but that doesn't mean you have to use them for this purpose.
Right.
You could choose to do something completely different if that's your pleasure.
Right.
And that's you could use them for this purpose. You could spend more, depending on your targets, of course.
Right. So it would.
But that's at your discretion. Madam Chair, that the legislature and the governor collectively made a decision to allocate money and build it into the planning estimates for 14 and 15. That was done. It's a little bit unusual. So it's worth being aware that that's there and that there are decision items to be made associated with that.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. And that's the reason we are having this conversation. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, you had said on paragraph E, it talks about $40.9 million for 14 and 68.4 for 15. And you said we have additional money? I'm trying to clarify where we're at with this.
We have a request, and the department will be talking about it. So we have the governor is making a request to support integration, and that was in the budget request from the governor. So that's separate. This is what we have at this point. What Mr. Nauman is explaining is what we have now.
Okay.
And so the policy committee will define, you know, how do we move, and the short and long term question for us is a very relevant one because we need to define, if let's say we change what we do now, how do we use these dollars? How do we connect with kind of the governor and the proposal that he's making and his staff? They will be speaking next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
it's a pleasure
you so
to return.
Much. Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Okay, so next in the agenda, we have different testifiers who hopefully will help us really review kind of the integration language we have. We have Bob Erickson and Helen Bassett. Please, I think he's.
This way.
Welcome to the committee, and thank you for helping us dive into this important conversation and really understand what we have been doing and what the recommendations are for the future. Please introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Education Policy Committee, my name is Bob Erickson, serving my second term on the Lakeville Area Public Schools Board of Education. I also serve on the Legislative Committee of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I am one of 12 members that served on the Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you this afternoon. Grateful for that. Move forward with the PowerPoint that I have presented to date to the House Finance, the Senate Finance, and the House Policy Committees. One of the important platforms within the Association of Metropolitan School Districts legislative initiative involves the creation of integrated and equitable learning environments, the importance of that. That's what the task force focused on during its work, which ran from October of 2011 through February 14th of 2012. Not only am I representing the interests of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, but I would be remiss, and I want to emphasize that I'm certainly representing the interests of 131 school districts that currently receive integration revenue for their programs. As the PowerPoint states, research clearly shows that students in integrative settings have a greater chance for success than students in segregated schools and classrooms. To ensure integrated and equitable learning opportunities and to increase achievement for all students, the governor and the legislature should follow the recommendations of the Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force. I say that respectfully. You know, the basis for the task force, the creation of the task force, in large measure came from the task force vantage point from the report by the legislative auditor back in 2005. And the legislative auditor, as you are aware, was quite critical of some of the programmatic elements and the lack of accountability and the ability to measure achievement. That's referenced in the letter. In previous presentations at hearings, it's become quite clear to me as the presenter that there's been a number of questions raised. I want to really emphasize that the task force, the second of 41 presentations was from the staff person in the legislative auditor's office that actually prepared the document. So the study, the report, if you will, and so we took that very seriously. And I reread the report 2 days ago just to refamiliarize myself with the content and to ensure and assure you that our recommendations clearly followed the concerns raised in the work that the legislative auditor did and presented to the legislature. That prompted the creation, as it's been referenced, of the task force, a 12-member task force, six appointed by the governor and six appointed by the Republican leadership. As it's been stated previously in other testimony by a number of individuals, no one expected an outcome by a majority of this task force. I think everybody assumed it would end up being approved on a, or something would have been forwarded on a 6-6 vote without a dominant position or recommendation. As you'll learn, that is not what happened. There's the members of the task force. Seated next to me is Helen Bassett, who's the vice chair of the Robbinsdale School District and also the chair of the West Metro Education Program. Pleased to have her accompany me today, and she will be speaking here in a moment. But we had a really excellent group of individuals, former legislator Myron Orfield, former legislator Senator Pam Wolf, former school superintendent of Minneapolis Schools, State Representative Carlos Mariani, just to name a few, just a great group of individuals that worked tirelessly. And by the way, we've created our own agendas, we created our own minutes, and we created our own report. I appreciate Minnesota Department of Education acting as a resource, but we decided to do all of that independently from any other entity, so it would be viewed as a very independent effort. Here's a photo of those individuals. The co-chairs are seated. Peter Swanson was one, and Scott Thomas, the other member that guided us through the process. I want to go over the recommendations very quickly. First of all, we want to create AIM. AIM stands for Achievement and Integration for Minnesota, funded through existing categorical revenues. As you probably know, and you just heard a few moments ago, the state levy, the state revenue that was provided and has been provided historically, is $68 million. However, what I want you to be aware of is that the school districts in Minnesota, the 131 participants, have a local levy and are contributing an additional $32 million. So this is a total of $100 million. I want to reemphasize the fact that local school districts are stakeholders and are paying for one-third of the program costs, which are under the auspices of an annual budget public hearing. Also, to ensure accountability and oversight, we certainly have been a strong advocate of stronger reporting and efforts to measure the effectiveness of the use of the revenue, which was one of the criticisms by the state auditor back in 2005. Clearly focus and define the use, making sure we submit meaningful plans, develop measurable goals, and budgets that limit their use. And by the way, this task force did not recommend that the legislature consider spending any more money than has been provided in the past. In other words, placing a cap on the revenue available for distribution at $68 million, again with a local levy authority of $32 million. So, innovative and accurate integrated learning environments, family engagement. I can't begin to impress upon you enough the importance of family engagement. That's where the liaisons, cultural liaisons that are funded under this program, are used by districts effectively, efficiently, and productively. And access to opportunity and increase the diversity of our teachers and administrators. And the last recommendation involved the possible consideration of one collaborative metropolitan integration school district. That is something that was brought forward and remains in the recommendation for consideration. Again, as I stated earlier, cap the existing revenue, level the fiscal disparities between demographically similar districts. Let me address that for a moment. I know that all of you know that Minneapolis and St. Paul have a high percentage of protected class students or students of color. But did you know that the percentage they have is equivalent to Columbia Heights, Brooklyn Center, Robbinsdale, Osseo, Wilmer, Worthington, to name a few? So this isn't a central city only issue. This is a statewide issue. And I'm sure you can appreciate that cities like Faribault and Wilmer and Worthington drive the economic engine outstate. And so the percentage of students of color is high, 63% in Worthington. We also were strong advocates of setting aside 0.2% to provide additional staffing for Minnesota Department of Education. Currently, they have one person that reviews 131 budgets. Difficult to have accountability in that scenario. Dr. Parks does an excellent job, but needs, in our opinion, additional assistance. We're not asking to fund more to pay for it. We're saying take the cost of that 0.2%, which is about $200,000, if you're interested to know, and take that from the existing revenue stream, which would benefit, in our opinion, all districts statewide in meeting our goals and objectives. Create a fiscal model that's predictable. You just heard a presentation from your staff person regarding the unpredictability of the current legislation that was carried over, and we need predictability. The legislation now sunsets the funding. So after fiscal year 14, for example, all the 131 districts lose their local levy authority. In other words, automatically $32 million is lost in the program after fiscal 14. Next issue is very, very important to the task force: define percentages of allowable expenditures. We want the majority of the money to end up in the classroom.
How much was it?
20% we want spent on professional development and administration, and under no circumstance do we want more than 10% of that money, total money, being spent on administrative costs. That was clearly indicated in the legislative auditor's report, and we certainly respect that, appreciate it, and based on the testimony, endorsed it. The Star Tribune gave the work of the task force a positive grade, and what was absolutely very rewarding to me as a task force member is we did this in a bipartisan manner. 10 of the 12 members adopted the recommendations. I guess that's almost unprecedented. But Star Tribune was very complimentary of the work that we did in achieving balance and support and providing for accountability. MnPost, some of you are familiar with this publication, also addressed the work that the task force did that we were forwarding on our recommendation per the statutory requirement to the commissioner, which we did, and we were on time. We did it, presented it to her on Valentine's Day of a year ago. This article also talked about two members of the task force who historically had not always agreed with each other's philosophies. That was Bob Erickson and Myron Orfield. 2013 AMSD legislative platform, again, places a high priority on creating an integrated and equitable learning environment. And in the interest of time, I'll let you just look that over. But the last bullet on that slide is very close to my heart, and that is AVID. AVID is a program that's been adopted by 31 school districts, proven to be successful in dealing with the achievement gap. It's been very successful in that regard. I'm not trying to take away from programs like Young Scholars or Jobs for America, but I want to emphasize that for those of us who have developed AVID, accepted it, and put it in our curriculum, we've had great results. Lakeville's been in the program for 5 years. I'll use us as an example. In that 5 years, we have over 300 students that are going to become college ready. The first graduating class of AVID in Lakeville, just 31 students. At the graduation event that I spoke at, all 31 had already been accepted at a 2 or 4 year college institution. And I want to assure you that 4 years earlier, that would not have been possible for this group of students of color. And now they are mentors, and they're coming back to the district and teaching the next class of graduates as they come forward. Without the funding from integration, this program would not be possible, in my opinion, for the districts that are participating in it to date. In the interest of time, I won't go through it. I just indicated that it's a college readiness system, and it's also allowed many of these students to become take AP classes and do things that were unheard of. And by the way, of the 31 graduates, half of the families of those graduates were present at the graduation ceremony and could not speak English, even in Lakeville, Minnesota. So the formula is simple. Raise expectations with the AVID support system in place, and they will rise to the challenge. It's about closing the achievement gap. Myron Orfield and I did make a presentation of this, of a similar presentation that you're receiving today, to the Education Finance Working Group. So we had that opportunity, so they were aware of our recommendations, and they incorporated many of our recommendations into the report that they submitted to the commissioner. On our website at AMSD, we have a position paper on school integration. In the interest of time, just want to call it to your attention. If you want more detailed information, you can go online at AMSD and read through that position paper, which was unanimously adopted by the members of the AMSD Board of Directors, representing 38 school districts and 3 integration districts, and serving 50% of the students in public schools in Minnesota. 38 school districts, 3 integration districts, serving 50% of the students in public schools in Minnesota. So with our recommendations, I'm just very grateful, Madam Chair, to the committee today to allow us to make this presentation. This is the fourth legislative hearing. I just want to reiterate, without a law change, the integration levy goes away for payable fiscal year 14, taxes payable 2013. You heard that earlier from your staff person. Keep in mind that the governor's omnibus education bill does not include a provision allowing us to levy, local levy authority for 30%. So we would lose 32 million dollars between 131 districts. The question you might have is, well, what are you doing about that? Well, of course, what are we doing about it? Is our school board adopted a plan that if we lose the $32 million, we're prepared to make the necessary adjustments. We're used to making cuts in education. Mm-hmm. And finally, we're seeking legislative, maybe unprecedented, but in the spirit of what we did as a task force, we're hoping that we could get some bipartisan consideration and possibly bipartisan approval to continue this important revenue stream. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Set you up in a minute.
I'll let him set that up, and I'm sure you can hear me, right?
Yes,
I'm Helen Bassett, and I am, as was said earlier, I am a board member at the Robbinsdale School District, where I've served for going into my 11th year. I'm currently the vice chair there, and I'm also the current chair of the West Metro Education Program, which is one of the metro located integration districts. And so thank you so much, committee, for hearing us today. We really appreciate it. Wonderful to have a hearing. My presentation is going up, and before I do my PowerPoint, I have a few comments I'd like to make, if that's okay.
Jim? Please proceed, Ms. Bassett.
Again, I say we thank the committee for the opportunity to share our comments about the work of our task force and the subject of integration for Minnesota in our schools. I appreciate being here at the table with my good colleague and respected colleague, school board member Robert Erickson from Lakeview. As I mentioned, I'll do my PowerPoint in a moment. As was stated, I served as a member of the task force. In addition to my service on the task force, I want to share a little bit more about myself. I'm a mother of an adult daughter, two adult stepchildren, seven step-grandchildren, and eight great-step-grandchildren for a total of 18 souls. Their experiences are part of the lens I look through to the question of school integration. I mentioned before I'm beginning my 11th year as a board member in the Robbinsdale School District and the fact that I serve on the West Metro Education Program. I want to just share with you that having entered school at the age of 5 and quickly turning 6 in the first grade, I had the great fortune to receive an integrated education, close on the heels of Brown versus the Board of Education ruling that came in about 1956 or so. Schooled in a northern, midwestern suburban community, my experience, unlike many children in 1956 America, began and continued throughout my education in an integrated environment. Little did I know at that time, and for many years following, how different that was, my experience was, from the experience of many, many children who looked like me. My parents, both hailing from the deep south of Mississippi, migrated to the north shortly after my birth. Their route took them briefly through Birmingham, Alabama. And had they stayed there, I could easily have been one of the three little black girls who died in the church that was bombed at the height of the racial segregation in the South. As I have grown older and a little more knowledgeable, my awareness of that reality has nestled in my consciousness in a way that helps me remember the scourge of segregation in a special and a personal way. So I come to this discussion as one who experienced integrated schooling as a matter of course. Indeed, it has only been in the last 25 years or so that I've come to realize that the ongoing discourse and the tension around integrated schooling is far from over. And as Professor Myron Orfield will tell us, the housing patterns in Minnesota have reconstituted patterns that have resulted in highly segregated living spaces in Minnesota. There are outcomes and realities shaped by that circumstance. We all come here today with the lived experience of moving through segregated and integrated environments on a daily basis, based upon our daily activities, our interests, our families, and our work life. We experience these spaces de facto. The skill that one has moving through these spaces matters. As a resident of a first-ring suburb and a representative of a first-ring suburban school district, a district that partners with the collaborative effort of WEMAP, we certainly realize that our charge, along with you, our partners, is to prepare our students to navigate a complex world, to prepare some of them to one day take your seats, to one day take mine. So the preparation of students to navigate a complex and changing world is part of our charge. I was proud to be appointed to serve as a member of the Integration Task Force, a task force that came to agreement and associated recommendations in a bipartisan fashion. My intention is to focus my testimony more from the perspective of a school board member in a local district, and of course, as chairs, we met where we come together many districts to try to achieve the same aims. And so I'd like to illustrate how that those funds are being used in our district a bit, and so then to my presentation. And they're only about 11 or 12 slides, so this shouldn't take me too very long.
Thank you. Ms. Bassett, could you make sure that the microphone is close to you so that we can hear you? Thank
sure.
you.
And, of course, I've kind of titled this, and I think it's kind of important to just talk about what we think we're doing. We're trying to provide culturally competent teaching, equitable, effective practices, policies, and partnerships with integrated opportunities for learning for all the students. So on our task force, what we did is that, and you can see for yourself, we spent a lot of time talking, and we engage in those conversations focused on the common good for students and staff within the context of the current constraints. And, of course, one of our recommendations is not to ask for additional funding, but to have the funding stay at the current level that it is. Now, having said that, without the levy authority, the end result of that will be that we will have less money. That is a concern. You know, and what I learned is when a conscious and deliberate equity focused is applied to teaching strategies, students of color and those dependent on free and reduced lunch can and do make academic gains. I know that from the results that we're getting at our district now and also from the testimony that we received from experts who came from across the country to be at our side, which was no small thing because they all came at their own expense. And if you've had an opportunity to look at the task force report, you'll see that it was a wide range of individuals who came and lent their support to Minnesota. And, of course, I feel like they owe that to us because quite often we're leading the way. And so Minnesota has led the way in many things for many years. And so this is an area that we do need to do better in. You know, it's very hurtful when I hear statistics that talk about Minnesota in terms of what we're doing for students of color being number 49 and number 50. And I know we can do better than that because we've done better than that on so many other fronts. And so who benefits from integration aid and why does that matter? Because Minnesota has changed. Hispanic students, the Star and Tribune just reported the other day that from 48,269 students in just 2011-12, we now have 59,625 recorded students. The surge in the immigration programs is another example of that. I also, read a story where it talked about how we're struggling to try to keep pace in terms of STEM and math and those kinds of things. I have with me the budget from the Robbinsdale School District for our integration revenue, and one of the things that we are paying attention to in our racially identified schools, and, of course, that's different from schools, there is a formula that talks about if you're adjacent to or close or contiguous to a district that has a certain concentration. And then, of course, for those districts that have, even within their own boundaries, additional difficulties and high concentrations. And so we really mirror both of those in Robbinsdale, and we're not alone. There are many districts that do. And so providing STEM training for our students and specialized education for them is something that we've really worked hard to do, and I know other districts are working just as hard. So our students do matter, and our staff matter. And a good part of how we target these dollars is that, people have talked about, I'll go to the final bullet that talks about early childhood education. We believe very firmly and strongly in early childhood education. And, in fact, I think that one of the recommendations that we have from the task force includes the permissiveness for using those dollars for early childhood education. But I want to be very clear. The dollars and the investment that we make early on that boosts those kids as they start out the gate. As they go along, the research shows us that when we start getting to middle school and fifth and even at the back end of elementary, students of color start losing ground. And so we can't just put all of our eggs in one basket and expect that that's going to carry them throughout their entire school career. it's just not going to happen. There are too many other factors that come into play. And so then we want to, the integration revenue allows us to uniquely leverage all of the other resources that we have, not the least of which is the general education funding that we get. And as you know, we, across Minnesota, there are billions of dollars spent for that. And so integration revenue, while coming to the conversation of academic achievement and being very focused on that and very committed to seeing that those dollars are very clearly targeted toward in a way that will bring us additional academic achievement, integration revenue alone cannot carry that weight and is not expected to. That's what our general education aid is for. But we do need to have a ways that we can leverage those dollars that aren't, because all of the other dollars that we get, except for general education, the compensatory aid and some of these others, they are targeted dollars and they're categorical funding that must be used in particular ways. Some of the innovative things that we can do across grade levels for students with integration revenue, if that goes away, it cannot happen. I have a quote here from Dr. Sokoli, who is our superintendent at Robbinsdale Schools, and he talks about the two-year plan. Professional development is key and very important. And here's the place where, in terms of shared resources, you know how important it is for local government and school districts also, as a matter of fact, to try to share resources whenever they can. Of the integration school districts that come together, and EMED is represented here today. I see their superintendent is here. Those kinds of collaboratives help us share resources, and that's very important. One of the resources that WEMA provides is the professional development for students. And, of course, as Dr. Sokoli says, we have a two-year plan for all of our licensed staff to participate in equity training. That focuses that training for and also for non-licensed staff as we're able. From Peter Eckhoff, who's our president of Robbinsdale Federation of Teachers, integration revenue is used to provide access to programs that students may not otherwise participate in. One major cornerstone of our use of integration revenue is paying for cultural liaisons, the individuals who provide invaluable resources. That connection between home and school is vital. And we have excellent staff who have been doing that work with us for some time. A 30% reduction for Robbinsdale means we lose $600,000. That's real people, real positions, that currently now, and as a matter of fact, we just met with members of our board. Our board has put together kind of a three-person team that's been looking at community connections and how we can connect with our community better. And one of the tenets of that is to see how we can connect with underserved or parents we don't normally see or not participating as much as we think that we'd like to see them and connecting with them. And in doing that work, we just had a meeting with our cultural collaboratives, and that's board members meeting with cultural collaborative members, which is a first in our district. But without the stability that these dollars provides, it doesn't help us as board members, because we have a duty, as you talk about policy and you talk about allocation of resources, it's important for us to do that as well, and we can't do that in a vacuum. And so it's important for us to kind of understand who are our students and who are their families and what do they need from us and what can we do. And so our liaisons are helping us understand that better. And so we're excited because we just had the opportunity to meet with them, and we haven't crafted all of the different ways we'll leverage each other and work together. But if that's destabilized, it sets us back. So, I wanted to just share that with you as well, because I think that's very important. And we talked about one of the ways we use them is that we just established a new science. We call our program STEAM, because in Robbinsdale we're all about the arts, so we had to include the arts in there. So it's not STEM, it's STEAM. But and we're really excited about that. And we used our liaisons to help us do outreach into the community, because quite often magnet school programs don't always attract some of the students who students of color. And so this was a way that we could, really try to make sure our magnet school more closely reflected our district. And we think that we were successful in that. And we couldn't have done that without the help of our liaisons. And so that was very important. I just you know, I have a couple more quotes, and you, I think, have my PowerPoint. I hope you do, and there
yes,
were some
we
copies
do.
Over
we
there.
Do, Ms. Bass.
So I don't want to belabor a lot of the comments because I've taken up some of your, so much of your time already, but I would point out, and, you know, Board Member Erickson has pointed out the value of AVID, and, of course, in our budget, we also dedicate funds toward AVID. We dedicate foreign funds toward the National Urban Alliance. These are respected programs that have showed promise and that have actually made a difference for students to actually not only graduate, but then actually go on to college. And the Project Lead the Way, that's a pre-engineering program that we have. And so I want to assure you that all of these programs aren't necessarily all funded by integration dollars, and I want to make sure to make that clear because we don't want to misrepresent. But the opportunity for us to leverage those dollars that we get, that you give us for general education funding, and thank you for the increased amount we got this last couple of years. We've been in a budget-cutting mode for years. And, you know, as Director Erickson talked about, that what are you doing if you get that $600,000 cut? Well, in Robbinsdale, we've looked at that, but we're not prepared to say that we're not going to get it.
Thank you, Ms. Bassett. That's a good way to end it.
Well, I think so.
Don't you apply
yes. Well, again, members, you know, this is my intent here is to give you an overview of the information that is out there, to connect you with the people who have worked on this, and to make sure. I would like to know if you did get a copy. You know, I don't want to inundate you with papers. You received so many papers, and probably you got a visit from the actual members, and they gave you a copy of the report. I understand that you did receive a copy of the report. If you haven't, absolutely we will send you a copy of the actual report of the Integration Task Force. Do you have any questions for the testifiers? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank the task force for their good work. And I have Mr. Erickson. I'm wondering if you can give me a little bit of idea on what I think might be one of the more challenging elements, which is the fiscal principle number 2 on your handout. And it's level the fiscal disparities between demographically similar districts. And I'm just curious, you know, how do you plan to do that? And I'll just give you a little perspective of my experience with this. I represent the communities of Rochester, Stuartville, Chatfield, Dover, Yoda, and the 14 townships around there. And we are real cognizant of the fact that I believe it's the integration funding that seems to be demographically spread in an unequal way. And the reason I say that is Rochester has more students of minority students than does like a city of Duluth. And yet there's more per pupil integration funding for Duluth students than Rochester students. And so how are you going to level that field?
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Erickson.
Senator Nelson, by the way, my daughter is a Rochester resident and a teacher. I served on the finance subcommittee of the task force. I was one of 5 members that served in that capacity. I think I chaired it. My background is public finance, and we looked at the disparity, and I'll go through that very quickly. Minneapolis, $480 a pupil unit. St. Paul, $445 a pupil unit. Duluth, $206 a pupil unit. Then it drops off to the majority of the remaining districts, which would be about 126 or 7, receiving between 129 and 92. Keeping in mind, though, out of respect to the current formula that was adopted several years ago, the demographic changes that have evolved have happened very quickly. Lakeville went from 6 to 16% students of color in just the last 4.5 years. But so other districts have seen a dramatic change of much greater proportion than that. Very quickly, the finance task force, or the finance subcommittee, came back to the full task force. Full task force was not comfortable coming forward with a specific recommendation other than what the recommendation states with regard to overcoming the disparity. However, I would be quick to point out that if the committee would be so inclined, if you would inquire of Dr. Melcher, who prepared at our direction, under our direction, a plan to address the demographically diverse distribution, the need to change the distribution formula for the districts, especially those having more than 40% protected class students or students of color. So an inquiry to Dr. Melcher, I have that in my pile, by the way, but I think would be in order. He's brilliant. He's knowledgeable. He was extremely helpful and did identify a formula similar to the work that he did for the working group, but he did that specifically for our task force. But we didn't adopt it because we just felt we weren't prepared to spend enough time to come forward with a specific change in the formula, although Dr. Melcher has prepared that, and I would encourage you to request it and look at it because it really effectively distributes money where it's needed, which is what the governor is saying in the omnibus education bill. Under his formula, there would be a redistribution of wealth. That would take money away from districts like Lakeville, and I'm okay with that because the money needs to go where the need is, and the need is when you have more than 40% students of color. I believe Rochester has 18% students of color, for example. So, but when you get into the students of color percentages over 40%, and they're receiving either 129 a pupil unit or 92, it doesn't work effectively, and that's why our recommendation is what it is.
And members, one of the issues that I want to make sure I am going to be I'm attempting to do this personally, just kind of diving into this information and getting the history. I have formed, I've asked members to take the lead on working committees. This is going to be my working committee, I guess. So I'm going to be contacting the department to help us, you know, understand that recommendation. And, you know, I serve in both committees, and I'm going to try to do my best to, you know, kind of bring that information back and forth. But I think this issue is so much about, you know, figuring out this formula, but also figuring out how do we do the business of integration and integrating kids effectively. So the policy question is so important. We could come up with a wonderful formula that distributes the few pennies that are attached to this concept very efficiently. Yet, I don't know if we have a policy recommendation that really helps us understand how do we support, you know, the education of our kids. So these, to me, these have to go together. And I would like to invite you to contact me if you want to be part of this conversation. I'm doing it as we speak, you know, trying to collect this information and make sure. So let me know if you want to be part of that group that is looking into that. I will be meeting with the department to get all the information they have, understand the governor's recommendation, how they want to do this. I understand that they also want to tie the Centers for Educational Excellence into doing more work in terms of supporting the districts in doing the work of integration, supporting teachers, supporting districts. So we're going to work very hard to kind of understand how these concepts integrate and how they help us deliver better results. Senator Nelson, sorry I interrupted your...
No. Oh, the very good comments, Madam Chair. I'm hoping that perhaps you could secure for us Mr. Melcher's recommendation. And just to clarify my comments, I know certainly demographics change and population changes, and we need to keep up with that. But my question specifically gets to the difference in the per pupil funding. So when it's per pupil funding, that's, you know, taken care of with the demographic changes. But my real question is, why are some students funded at over $400 per student and others in more diverse situations are funded at, you know, $129 per student? And my real question was, how are you, you know, and we'll get this from Dr. Melcher then, how do we go about changing that in a fair way? And I appreciated the fact that you mentioned that it's revenue neutral, the recommendations from this committee, and I applaud you for that because we don't hear that very often. So I know that was not easy, and so I applaud you for that, and I'll look forward to seeing that report.
Thank you, and yeah, I look forward to do that as well. And we will connect with Dr. Melcher to make sure that we do. If the recommendation from the task force was that we really look into that seriously, we will definitely do that. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Erickson or whoever, and following up on Senator Nelson's question, I'm wondering, I think I was looking for the numbers for Rochester and Duluth so that I could compare them, and I missed some of the conversation here. But I would really appreciate if you would address, like, Rochester is at 31.9%, that's 2011-12 enrollment, 31.9%, and they receive $129 per pupil. And then Duluth is 18.7%, and they get $206 per pupil. If you could maybe ask Dr. Melcher to just take those two school districts, compare them for us, for me, I should say, and let us know how they came out, how they came to those numbers.
So, Senator,
so it might
Johnson
be transportation, it might be something else, but I'd like
what
to know.
What we will do, I think, I'm trying to figure out, Senator Weaver is not here, but maybe with you, obviously, you are the vice chair of that committee, we can ask that question and go over those numbers. So, Mr. McHenry, if you can take a note on that. You know, one of the issues that we're running into is kind of running out of time on how we inform each other about this. So, I feel that I may have to bring this to your attention, Senator Johnson and Senator Weaver, to see if we can combine perhaps a time to go over kind of the policy and the funding so that all of us are kind of in the same page. We will do that request, and please, Mr. McHenry, if you can note that that we would like to hear that from the department, that would be very helpful. Any other questions, members? Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could very quickly, I want to reiterate that Dr. Melcher, in this case, was a resource responding to information that we had provided him and trying to redistribute in a more equitable manner the resources. I would encourage you also to ask your staff person in the governor's office. He has a formula in the bill, in the omnibus bill, on how to redistribute this, and I have not seen a printout, an Excel printout showing how that would look compared to the current distribution. So that could be another piece of this information.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, Mr. Erickson. And I know that, you know, in the finance committee, they're trying to kind of put these pieces together, and I have the bill, so I just have to pull it all together. But we will get there. We did have a wonderful presentation in the House. The House is kind of ahead of us, and they did a House and Senate presentation because they have had the conversations for multiple years. You know, Representative Mariani has had the bill for multiple years, so they have had an opportunity. But we'll get there. Ms. Bassett.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, of course, you know, the city of Minneapolis Public Schools is a part of the West Metro Education Program Collaborative. And so at recent conversations, I certainly do not want to speak for them and cannot. But one of the position that they've taken is that, of course, you know, they're one of the ones who get the higher amount of money, is their flexibility and willingness to look at that because they believe that this is so important. So I think that just that posture from Minneapolis is a good posture, and I would just share that with this committee. And the one last thing that I guess I would say is, I think I'm not sure how many of you might have seen the news and seen some of the tension that erupted over at South High School the other day. And, you know, what was reported, and I do not know if it's true or not, but what was reported was the tension between African-American students and Somali students. I say to you, this is one of the most important tasks I think you have before you. Our country is becoming more and more complex and more different. And if we can't prepare our students to be able to live together and work together cooperatively, and just as we're sitting here in this room and trying to get things done, I'm afraid to think about where we're headed as a country, as a state, and how we're really leaving things for our kids. So I just urge you to thank you for taking this matter up. We really need you to be thoughtful about it. You know, Board Member Erickson is right. We didn't put forward a formula because we thought we'd leave that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bassett. I I so appreciate that comment. It just so happened that my kids go to South, so I'm fully involved in that conversation. And I understand the struggles of my own district in dealing with, you know, the beauty of diversity that they have in their schools, but also the challenges to bring us together. So this is very important and very dear to me. And then, you know, understanding that the entire state of Minnesota, there are people of color, minorities in the 87 counties of the state, and that we have not dealt with a significant issue that has been with us for more than 100 years in terms of addressing the inequalities that exist with Native American kids, when only 38% of kids are graduating from high school in this state. And that's just a shame. We've known that for many, many, many years, and we haven't really addressed that. So we have significant challenges, and I think that this committee is really committed to move us in the right direction. You know, I just don't think that we do have the resources that are necessary to fully address the needs today, but we have to use what we have effectively. Any other questions, members? Well, thank you again for the work that you did with us and for us. I just really appreciate, you know, the work that so many volunteers do for our kids. There was no compensation. You met for a number of hours to help us really dive into a conversation that is quite difficult, and you came up with recommendations that are very important. So thank you. Thank you for all of that work. And members, please review this information carefully. Please think about recommendations that you want to submit to my office, and let us know if you need anything from the department. I think they are very willing to come. They are here. I don't know if there is any information you wanted to provide, Mr. McHenry. Okay. But they are willing to engage in a conversation with us and provide the information that we need to proceed. So feel free to ask. Let me know if you need more information, and let me know if you need a copy of the report. So if you don't have any other questions, we will adjourn for today. Thank you.